know y'all did that just to humiliate me. I know there's some short girls down here in AA. My name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Steve. My sobriety date's February 5th of 85. And for that period of time, I try to be grateful. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Baxter for inviting me. And, you know, I know lots and lots of people here, and to get invited somewhere where you know lots of people is nice, sort of. You know, you can't really hide much though. They know too much already. You can't really recreate your story if there's so many people here. And I don't mind lying in front of Mike or Baxter really, but the president of Alcoholics Anonymous in North Texas is down here in the front, and I know better than that. Larry let me borrow his watch, and I'm going to try to really use it for what it's intended for, I promise. And I want to thank Brett for coming with me. You know, once in a while, you get a new guy that is just gung-ho, dying to be here, wants to work the steps, wants to get involved, wants to take direction and make his phone calls and do all that, you know. Now, Brett is not like that at all. But I'm working with him until one comes along, and well, I'm glad he came along for the ride. I told Chris when I got here, I really didn't have much to say. I lectured Brett all the way down here. I'm kind of tired, really. But anyway, I never know where these deals are going. I'm glad to be here. I could tell a story tonight that was so sad. It would bring a tear to a glass eye. And this has been really rough for me lately. And I talked to my sponsor on a regular basis, and he said, Steve, nobody wants to hear your sorry bunch of sad mess. They invite you to share your experience, strength, and hope. So if you don't have any, you just lie and tell them you do. So that's what you're going to get today. I really believe that. I sometimes you get so wrapped up in yourself, it doesn't matter how long you've been here, that I'm so grateful that Brett came along. I got a call this morning from a guy that I've known in AA for a long time, and I cried on his shoulder for about an hour, and he cried on mine, and we were much better when it was over. And I thanked him so much for calling. Brett came down here. We worked a step on the way down here in the car. I ran off and left my shoes and my tie. We had to stop. We found a Tractor Supply, and I bought me some boots so I could have something to wear. And Baxter loaned me a tie, so I appreciate that. So I'm fully dressed, in my right mind, sober, prepared for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is not how I got here, I assure you. And I don't know ever how to kick these things off. It's appropriate that we're in a church tonight, I think. I grew up in a church. My dad was a preacher. My mom played the piano. I tell all the time, my dad has, 69 years of sobriety, and my mom has 68 years of sobriety, continuous of sobriety at this time. Not members of Alcoholics Anonymous, all right? They're 69 and 68 years old, and they've never drank, not even a little cooking wine, nothing. They don't drink a bit. I don't know why that I took to it, just like a duck to water. I just did. I think a lot of it had to do with they said don't do it. I don't know why I was that kind of kid, but somebody said I just needed more fun than the average Baptist. I don't know. But they would tell me not to do something, and I never said, okay, that's a good idea. Oh, I won't do that. I always want to know, why? Why don't they want you to go there? Why don't they want you to do that? You know, and I was a weird kid right out of the gate. I don't know why. I'm the kind of kid that, you know, I learned how to smoke when I was about 5 years old. Nobody in my family smoked. They did not smoke cigarettes. I would sneak off to one of my buddies' house. We'd get a pack of smokes, go sit out in a wheat field under this mulberry tree. I sit out there a lot. We'd sit out there and learn how to smoke cigarettes. A year or two later, sit out there under that same mulberry tree. We got us a rainbow bread sack and a can of gold paint, and we learned how to huff paint, you know. And you can take a trip and never leave the farm, you know what I'm saying? You don't meet a lot of paint huffers in Alcoholics Anonymous, really? They don't live past 16 or 17 years old for the most part because they all die from huffing paint. Paint gave me a terrible headache, and I didn't do it very often. I quit right away. I would still pop the top off the tank of the tractor and take a big huff once in a while just for giggles. My mom caught me one time. Somebody told me this story, and I tried it out. I'm in the grocery store with my mother. I don't know. I couldn't have been 11, 12 years old. I was still with my mother, and I got all the gas off the whipped cream bottles. You know, if you take that gas off the whipped cream bottles and just don't take the whipped cream out, just hit the gas, it'll just give you a ride. And I'm knocked out in the aisle with the whipped cream bottles laying all around. I don't know. I'm just weird like that. I'm just strange. And I don't know why I always wanted to be somewhere where I wasn't. Wherever I was, I wanted to be somewhere else. And I've always been that way. My mother said I would leave with the mailman when he came by if she would have let him. I just wanted to go. I wanted to get out of where I was. And eventually, thank the Lord, I found whiskey. When I was about 12 or 13 years old, I got a drink. I needed one, I promise you. Again, you know, huffing paint is not a long longevity experience. So whiskey saved my life, more than likely. But it wasn't, you know, I mean, I can't romanticize it. It was horrible. It was nasty. It was terrible. It burned. It was, you know, everything was wrong with it. I didn't like the taste, but the effect was immediate and worth whatever price I had to pay to get it again, you know. And and then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we could run this thing pretty short if you want to know the truth. I am not a man who had a long drinking career. I started real early and finished early. That line in the book where it talks about, you know, female alcoholics can be gone in just a few years. And I always think, well, you're such a wimp. You know, I can't get over it sometimes, but I didn't amount to anything. I heard somebody say in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two kinds of people here, has-beens and never-wases, and I'm of the latter variety. I never was anything, never was going to be anything. I was just an average drunk. I got drunk, and I stayed that way as often as I could. And I grew up way out in the country. I worked on a farm. We farmed and ranched, raised cattle, riding tractors. I was riding tractors to school when I was in the ninth grade. I would ride the tractor halfway to school because I'd feed on the way there, and I went by a little old package store, and I'd stop, and the old man in there would put me a couple of quarts of Miller on the truck or whatever was on sale that day on the tractor. He'd walk it out and put it on the cab of the tractor, and I'd be off to school. And a lot of times, I didn't even have to drink it on the way to school. You know what I mean? A lot of times, just having it with me made me feel good enough that I could go to school. But there were times, too, that I didn't pay my bill or the old man wasn't there, he wasn't open or whatever, and I couldn't get anything to drink. And bless her heart, my mother taught school. She was the school teacher. And now, she never let me in her class because she didn't allow boys like me in her class. But she taught business class and accounting and short stuff like that. And I was never allowed in there. But she would drive me to school. I would ride with her to school. We would get out, and she would watch me walk in, and I would come up missing. You know what I mean? I mean, I drove her absolutely crazy. I really believe that. I absolutely drove her over the edge. My mother loved me so much and still does, and we've rebuilt the relationship. I had dinner with her last night. It is good. We have a good relationship, but it's taken a lot of years, you know. Anyway... there were days I just couldn't go, but when I had something to drink, when I had some even in my locker or with me or out in the car underneath the seat, if you're new tonight and you've got a jug underneath the seat of your car, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You can endure even Alcoholics Anonymous if you have something to go home to. You know, I understand that. I do. Know now, you know, that I became an alcoholic very quickly. By the time I was 16, I was a daily drinker as often as I could. Again, I grew up real fast. I was doing man's work. I was out in the world working and drinking, and I learned how to carry a flask in your hip pocket, and I learned how to roll your own, them non-habit forming marijuana cigarettes, you know. I learned how to do that real early. And when I was 16, my folks sent me off to church camp. It's about halfway between here and from between Dallas and home. It's called False Creek. It's a week-long deal. I know there's some Baptists here that have been there. I won't ask you to raise your hands. If I owe you money or amends from there, I'll just make them right now, blanket, you know. But anyway, they sent me down there, and about Wednesday, I run out of booze and dope, and they were playing them songs that they play at the church camp, you know, Almost Persuaded and Just As I Am and all that stuff. And I knew, you know, I knew. You didn't have to tell me. I've been in church every... My mother carried me to church from the hospital. You know what I mean? I was in church every Sunday from there on out. I had been there every Sunday. I knew how I was living was wrong. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And I really wanted to change. And I'm 16 and I want to change. And so I walked down the front and I'm going to change. And I promise you, I may not have done it for the right reasons. I may not have done it for the... with any sense of purity or moral correctness or anything like that, but I did it for, I was much more sincere that night than the first night I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I promise you, I was much more sincere, and I walked out front and I began to speak to a counselor and tell him I want to change. And they have a three-step program in the Baptist Church. We have a 12-step program here in AA. We kind of extend them a little bit. And we did the first three steps, basically. I mean, I admitted, I believed, I confessed, or I said a little prayer, and I began to do sort of a confession with this fellow, and he didn't want to hear it. And I'll never forget, I started just kind of spilling my guts because I wanted to get a lot of the stuff I'd been doing off my chest, and I wasn't being real specific, but I was, you know, some of the ones that were bothering me, I kind of hit the high spots, and his eyes rolled back in his head, and he started patting his chest, and he went, "Oh Lord, oh Lord, oh Lord," and he said, "That's enough. You're forgiven. You're forgiven." And I mean, I'll never forget that, because I turned around and walked away knowing I wasn't forgiven. I knew I wasn't forgiven, you know. Now, theologically, I don't know if that's correct. Maybe I was forgiven. I don't know. But I'll tell you this, I never felt forgiven. I didn't feel forgiven that day. I didn't feel forgiven all the days I spent in church after that. I didn't feel forgiven until I did that inventory and started making those amends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found a forgiveness. I found a peace. I found a serenity that I was not available to me before here. That has allowed me to go back to that same kind of church and be a part of and fit in real well. But it was a long time coming, you know. So I make this big decision and I get baptized, and I sponsor this preacher that lives out in Hobbs, New Mexico, and I've told him this story 100 times, and he always tells me, he says, "Boy, the only way that baptism was going to do you any good is if they held you under till the bubbles quit coming up." Because I believe him. I come up out of the water, and one of the girls in the choir bent over to pick up her hymnal, and I kind of gave her a look, and I thought, "Oh Lord, you didn't wash all them sins away, preacher. Maybe you better run me back down in there. I don't know what I need. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm still bad. I know I'm still bad." But I'm one of them, so I got to participate. And I join up, and I'm gung ho, and I go, and I can't stay sober. It's the most pitiful thing, as far as I'm concerned. It's still the riddle of our existence. When we cannot, we do not want to drink, and we get drunk anyway. And, you know, it would just happen. I would go a week or 2 or 3 days, and I wouldn't have a drink, and I'd run into one of my buddies at the swimming pool or something, and they'd say, "Hey, have a drink," and I'd just take it. And nonchalantly, just as normal as a day is long, have a drink of it, and then think, "Oh, my gosh, I wouldn't go and get drunk today. I'm not supposed to do that anymore. I'm not like that anymore. I'm changed. I'm different. I went to church." And then I think, "Well, you've already started. You might as well go ahead and get drunk today, and you can quit tomorrow." You know what I mean? Or sometimes I wouldn't think at all. Sometimes I just find myself drunk. I mean, one time I stopped by the little country swimming pool there, And I just stopped in there to say hi. And I woke up in the seat of my truck the next morning, you know, passed out, thrown up on the floorboard. I don't know what happened. I had no intention of drinking when I stopped in there. I made it through high school and went off to college. And the only time that I was able to stay sober was in between high school and college. I stayed sober about, I think it was about 8 weeks. And mostly because I worked on a farm and just stayed out in the country for 8 weeks. I just stayed away from it completely. And I go down there and I see some friends of mine that I rodeoed with and partied with, and I knew them. And they said, we went to a little junior college down here in southern Oklahoma in Tishomingo. And they said, let's run over into Texas and get some of that Armadillo beer. I was like, oh, no, y'all haven't heard. I don't do that anymore. You know, I've quit. I've changed. Didn't you hear? I'm a new man. And they said, oh, come on. And I said, okay. And we went. And 3 days later, I come back, all right? I mean, I completely missed the first 2 days of college. We got to one of them joints. Now, I'd been to some of the little beer joints around Shawnee. They weren't much, you know, they weren't much at all. But we got to one of these joints over here in Grayson County. I think they called it the Electric Company or something. And it was, I promise you, it was a hopping place. Pretty women and loud music. And, I mean, it was getting it on. And I thought, this is living. That preacher's been lying to me about what goes on in these places. I'm all for it. And I didn't want to leave. I remember throwing the keys to my truck to one of them guys that night and saying, I'll find my way back. Y'all go ahead. You know, like it says in the book, you know, it just can't last. If it was always that fun, always that, I'd still be doing it. I promise you. But the guilt and remorse that lives with us from living the lifestyle that we live, I can't shake it. I can't get rid of it. I blame it on the church. I blame it on the preacher. I blame it on, well, that's not it. You know, we're human, and we feel guilty when we do that kind of stuff. And I continue to get worse. And then some things happened. Our family farm went broke, and the girl I wanted to marry, she dumped me. I didn't tell you a story about this girl. Brett knew her growing up. I fell in love with this girl's dad's money. I mean, oh, she was so rich. It was unbelievable. I'd own a chain of treatment centers by now if I could have got her knocked up, I'll tell you. If I could have got pregnant, we'd have been married the first week. Anyway, she dumped me because she didn't want to be married to a drunk. And something else terrible happened. I can't remember what it was, but it was horrible. And I made a deal with God. Now, up to this point, from the time I went to that church camp to this point, I'm praying, I'm going to church every time the doors are open, and I'm staying sober part-time at least. You know, I could sober up on Sunday, at least, at a minimum, I would sober up and pray and repent and try to do better and get drunk and do it all over again. But I'm living a complete double life, trying to be sober and be with this girl and do all this stuff and that. And when that all went south, it was just like, why bother, you know? And I remember making a deal with God. All right, God, if you don't ever ask me for anything again, I'll never ask you for anything again. I'm finished with you. We're done. And I went to the liquor store and got myself a bottle. And I went on about a 3-year running drunk that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, really. But as far as I know, God has never reneged on the bargain that we made that day. He has never asked me for a thing. As a matter of fact, I come to find out, he doesn't really need me, believe that or not. But I would find my religion on occasion, if you know what I mean. If you get arrested and you got a quarter pound of hippie hay underneath the seat of your car, you will pray. I mean, you would pray. I prayed, Lord, I know you made blind people see. Please make them blind when they go out there and look underneath my car. I was praying, boy. I was praying. When you have an end-over-end car crash, there are very few pure atheists in an end-over-end car crash. You will not scarcely ever hear somebody cry out, oh, cosmic theory of power, you know, as you're going end-over-end. They'll be crying out for Jesus, I promise you. They'll make a deal. You think you're going to die. You start remembering them stories you watched on Sunday morning on TV. Yeah. Yeah, and I was not above that. I would do it every time. I would go back to it, but it never did any good. And I lived a boring Charlie Brown kind of life, and I never got away with anything. I mean, just stupid stuff. I wanted to be. We were talking about a friend of ours that always thinks he's the kingpin gangster, and that's what I wanted to be, was the kingpin gangster, you know. But kingpin gangsters don't get arrested for shoplifting food out of the grocery store because they're starving to death. You know what I mean? I got in a blackout, and, well, I don't know. But anyway, I assume I was in a blackout, and I assume I was with them because I got arrested and in jail for stealing all the flags off the municipal golf course at Tishomingo, Oklahoma. I don't remember doing it. I don't remember being there. I don't remember anything about it. But they say we did it, and I did my time. I got DUIs, and I got possessions, I got picked up over and over and over and over. I tried to live a life of crime. I was going to be a burglar, and most of the time, by the time I get drunk enough to get up the courage to break in your house, I would think, oh, just let them keep it. I don't, you know. We'll be all right till tomorrow. We'll find something else to steal, you know. If you just left it out in the front yard, I'd pick it up and carry it off. But I didn't. I couldn't hardly do it, you know. I just couldn't hardly do it. And I just kept getting in more trouble, more trouble, more trouble. And it was all, nothing but a bunch of nickel and dime stuff, DUIs and public drunks and petty theft and petty crime and just stupid, stupid stuff, you know. Nothing ever cool happened to me, ever. I lost my driver's license right off the bat. I bought a motorcycle so I could run from the cops, all right, because I was not going to go to jail anymore. I bought a 750 Yamaha. I just leave them behind. And the first day I get it, I'm sitting on this thing drunk in a hootel, and I hear the sirens go off, and I was riding with a friend of mine, and I said, hey, I'm out of here. I'll see you later. And I turned around just to see how far lead I had on him. And there was one motorcycle cop we have in our whole county sitting about this far away from me with the siren and lights on. And I just pulled over and went to jail. You know what I mean? I mean, nothing ever good happened to me. Nothing. And I got caught at everything I ever did. I thought at the time it was horrible, but it really is the best blessing because I didn't get away with stuff. I was punished regularly, and so anyway I got another DUI. I opened up the door of my car and fell on the street. It's hard to pass a drunk test when you do that, and they hauled me in, and I know I'm in my own little hometown. My friends had just got arrested by the OSBI. They'd been rounded up on a big drug connection, and I wasn't with them because I was too drunk to make the run with them, and they didn't want me to embarrass them. And that's the only reason I wasn't with them. And I went back to my hometown to change my life again. I'm going to do right. And you know how it is. Everywhere we go, there we are. We're with us, and things get worse. And I made it about 2 weeks and got another DUI, and I'm back in jail. I don't even know what I'm in there for. I woke up. There was a guy that in our hometown, it's not a big homeless community, at least it wasn't then. And so everybody knew this guy because he was kind of strange and lived on the streets. And he had long hair and long beard, and we called him Jesus, you know. And I woke up all snuggled up with Jesus in the drunk tank that morning. And I'm thinking, why is a nice boy like me doing a place like this with people like him for crying out loud? You know, this jailer should be talked to. And they chain us together and take us upstairs so they can fingerprint us and tell us what we're in there for, and they drag us by a big picture window. And I looked over at this window, and me and Jesus looked like twin brothers. I mean, I got this long hair. I got this goofy-looking beard. I mean, it wasn't a beard. It was like a goat. It wasn't a goatee, really. It was just, and I'd thrown up on myself in the night. I hadn't shaved or bathed, no telling how long, and I don't even know what happened. You know, in my mind, I'm that guy that just left for college, you know, that is going to be something and do something and really turn it on, and I'm gone. I'm just gone, and I cannot stop drinking. And by this time, I'm finding notes that I've leaving to myself. You know, if you don't quit drinking, blow your brains out. I give my guns away to friends so I don't kill myself or somebody in a blackout. I come to one night, two buddies of mine had found me, and I come to, and they're sneaking down the wall trying to get away from me, you know, and I didn't even know they were there, and I was like, hey, what's going on, guys, you know, and I was in a blackout. I've been in there. I realized I got this big wet spot on my front of my shirt because I'm crying. I got a big old snot bubble hanging out my nose, you know. I'm crying to them because I tell them I can't quit drinking. I don't know what I'm going to do. I cannot quit. And I get that DUI, and I don't know what to do. I mean, I don't know what to do. I've been to the Southern Oklahoma Mental Institute. I'm sure I may have heard something about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to DUI schools, and I'm sure I might have heard something about Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was nowhere in my brain, at least that I knew of, to think, go to Alcoholics Anonymous, call Alcoholics Anonymous. So I go see this lawyer that I still owed money, and see if she'll take me on again. And she says, you know, you're going to go to prison. There's no way around it. We've got you out of these other deals, but we got another DUI that's only 90 days old, and you're going to go to prison. And she said, the judge might go easier on you if you'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I swear I looked at her like she had a horn growing out of her head. You know, I mean, it's like, me? Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you kidding me? What would give you that impression? I was flabbergasted, but I took her advice. Oh, yes, that's a good idea. Thank you, thank you. And I left there thinking, that's never going to fly. I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go to church. So I went down to the church, and there was a guy there that I thank every time I see him, and every time I think about it, I call him and thank him on my birthday. But I go down to the church, and I see this guy, and for some reason I was in the mood to be honest that day, because he asked me what was wrong, and I said, I can't quit drinking. And he quizzed me about it because he wanted to be sure. He said, are you sure? You really can't quit. You've tried. What have you done? And I by the time we're done, I'm just bawling and crying. And I don't know what to do. I just tell him, I cannot stop. I've tried everything. I cannot stop. And he said, well, he says, we're going to pray for you. And so he prayed for me. And then he got up and he walked toward the back door. And I thought, well, he's going to take me somewhere. And he said, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he pushed me out the door and locked it. Click. You know? And that's pretty much it. I mean, my own kind won't even take me back. I figure I've gone too far. I'm sunk. I don't know what to do. And so I leave there and I go back to where I'm staying with some other guys, and I start drinking and trying to figure out what the heck I'm going to do. And my mother finds me. And, you know, I told you again, my mother, she would breathe for me if she could. She is a great lady. But she had no idea what to do. My dad had thrown me out of the house when I was 17, and by the time I was 18, they had decided it was easier for them to pretend I was dead than it was for them to acknowledge the way I was living. And so they disallowed my name to be brought up at anything. My little brother and little sister couldn't even ask about me. They were done with me, and she finds me that day, and she's going to send me to treatment. Now, I had no idea what treatment was. I've never been to treatment, and I wish I could go. I'd go check in today if I could. I mean, really, if you could get me 30 days off, free meals, nice, cool place to sleep, I mean, come on, who wouldn't want to do that? I thought it would be torture. I really did. I thought they would tie you up to a whipping post and beat you until you swore you didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't know. I mean, I couldn't imagine any kind of psychobabble that was going to do me any good. And she's wanting to send me to treatment, and I'm like, no way. I ain't going. No way. And for the truth is, I didn't want to quit drinking. You know, I couldn't imagine being locked up somewhere where I couldn't drink. But I won't go, and she's crying and everything else, and I tell her, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I finally get her to leave, and I get on the phone with Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there was a lady in our town named Mary Alford who's since passed on, and she was the inner group for Shawnee, Oklahoma. She was confined to a wheelchair. She died with right at 30 years sobriety. But the way she did 12-step work was she was homebound most of her adult life. She answered the phone in 12-step alcoholics, and she could work it just like clay. Well, I mean, she would just work in. I called, you know, my friend wondered about AA, and you know, 15 minutes later, woo, I'm crying, and yeah, it's me, you know, and she's working me over, trying to get me to give up my address, or I think she could send somebody to get me, and I'm looking over in the cooler, and I still got some beer to drink, and I won't give it. And so we talked for a while, and finally she gives up. My beer lasted longer than her talking. She gave up, and she gave me the address for the meeting that night. And I drank everything I could get my hands on in order to prepare myself to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know how you got here, but that's how I got here. I put on my best rock and roll T-shirt, you know, that I had with the sleeves cut out, and it probably had somebody giving you the finger on the front or something. I don't know. And I don't know what I'm getting into. I have no idea. You know, I'm drunker than a rat, and I go to AA. And it's amazing. And the group that I got sober, I know it was a Tuesday or Wednesday night because they were doing a book study meeting. I know that they didn't change the format for me because they didn't ever change it for anybody else that came in because they didn't change it for me. They had a couple of big guys that sat one on either side of me. They gave me a half a cup of coffee, offered me a smoke, and they had their meeting. This, as far as I'm concerned, is the corniest part of my story. I sat there with people who were older than dirt, for God's sake. Now, I was 20 years old. These people were 30 and 40 and 50, some of them. And I can understand, yes, you need to sober up and make peace with God. You know, you're going to be with him soon. You should straighten your life out, for God's sake. What am I doing here? But I start listening to these people talk, and I thought my lawyer or my mother had called down there to tell them I was coming. Because I never, ever heard anybody talk about the stuff that they talked about, in front of girls and everything, that about the way they drank and the way they tried to quit and the fact that they couldn't. I'd never heard that anywhere that I know of. I'd heard all the, you know, when I was locked up down at the Nut House in Ada, they were, you know, told us about the THIQ and the 80% of the people drink, you know, whatever. 20% of the people drink 80% of the booze and all this stuff. It didn't mean nothing. I was fascinating information, but it didn't mean a thing. And they always prodded and poked you about how much you drink and what your drinking is. And everybody you ever stood in front of, whether it's the judge or the district attorney or your lawyer or your mom or your dad, your football coach, your friends, your girlfriends, everybody, they want to talk to you about your drinking. We're going to talk about your drinking. When you go talk about my drinking, the walls go up. I'm not prepared to talk about my drinking with just anybody. I'll tell you that right now. Because I know it's the only thing that keeps me alive. I know it's the only thing that keeps me from blowing my brains out. I know it is. I can't stand the pressure otherwise. And everybody that tried to talk to me about my drinking, if they had a power or authority over them, I might say, well, yes, sir, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. I will be glad to follow your directions as soon as I leave here and you dismiss this case. You know, and I'd be nice to them. And if you didn't have nothing over me, if you were my mom or some coach or something that you couldn't really swing a stick at me, I might spit at you and tell you to leave me alone. No, I'm not hurting anybody but me. Get away from me. And I don't talk about my drinking because I don't know what to do about it. I can't stop. You don't understand. And these people talked about their drinking. And I understood. And I believe to this day that the talk that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous, the one alcoholic talking to another, the sharing of the way, what happened and what it was like and what it's like today, is music to a real alcoholic's ears. We can't help everybody, but a real alcoholic hears that talk, and they know that we understand. And it was the first time in my life I had ever talked to anybody that understood. I had tried. They brushed me off like I was some dumb kid. You know, I tried to talk to people a couple of times, but no one had ever talked to me that understood exactly where I was coming from. And I knew they knew. There was no doubt. And I was sold on the first night. I mean, I was absolutely sold. I didn't stop drinking. I didn't get the whole message right off the bat, okay? I was really, really drunk. And they stayed with me the whole, you know, after the meeting, a guy appointed himself my sponsor, and you know, I didn't have to sit in a few meetings and find someone I identified with. He said, I'm your sponsor. And I said, okay. Now, granted, I thought being a sponsor would be someone like, you know, like you sponsor a race car and, you know, you give him money. And I thought he might give me some money. I knew he owned a business here in town. Figured he was kind of flush. And that wasn't it at all. That turned out that wasn't it at all. But he was just nice and friendly and talked to me that night and told me his story and 12-stepped me and told me he'd be my sponsor and I was to call him every day and that's what we do. And again, that was the one nice and friendly talk that we had for about the next 4 or 5 years, because I was a goofball, you know. Now I like to tell Brett, that's new, that I was so willing and honest and humble newcomer that I did everything my sponsor told me to do. I know that's not true, but I would like for him to do that. But I'm telling you, this guy would drive across town every night of the week to come and get me for the meeting. He'd drive over, he would lecture me all the way back to the meeting about something I did or said that day. Tell me about, you know, to stay away from the girls at the meeting, that this needs to be a safe place for them to get sober, and they didn't need some loser like me hanging around and bothering them. And then we'd go to the meeting, we'd smoke about 2 packs of cigarettes. Everybody smoked at the meeting them days, you know. I still think it's hilarious. We had a meeting that was about the size of this stage, you know, and there'd be 20 of us in there, 18 of us smoking, and there'd be a no-smoking section over here in the corner. The non-smoker could sit over there so we could make fun of them. Loser, you know. And the room would just be full like a cloud. You know, it looked like you could get less smoke sitting in a smoker. You know what I'm saying? A barbecue pit has less smoke than that we'd have in there. It's hilarious today. But anyway, we'd sit in there, smoke, drink coffee, stay up till midnight or 1. Talking after the meeting. He would lecture me all the way back home, tell me about the new girl I tried to talk to or something stupid I'd shared and blah, blah, blah. Now, I mean, I'd get out. He had this old Jeep, and I'd get out of his Jeep after he would get done, and I would think, I'm going to break the window glass out of this thing. I would just slam the door, and I would curse myself for a weakling for not stabbing him in the eye on the way home. I would think... You're a grown man. You don't have to put up with this crap. You could kill him and get away with it. Everybody would appreciate it. He's nothing but trouble. And I would swear I'm never going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, ever. It was just the stupidest place. A bunch of old people hang out there, and I'm not going back. And I would get up the next morning, I'd call him and listen to him gripe me out about something else, and I'd go to work, and I'd work all day, and I'd try my best not to drink all day long, and I'd get there, and I'd wait for him to come pick me up, and he'd lecture me all the way to the meeting. We'd sit through the meeting, we'd smoke a couple packs of cigarettes, drink 4 or 5 pots of coffee. I'd get home, can't figure out why I can't sleep, you know. I'd get out of his car, slam the door, curse myself for not killing him again, go to the hurt. It was just insane. I thought I was gone completely insane. For the first about year and a half that I was with y'all, I wanted to drink more than I wanted to breathe. I mean, I just wanted to drink. My uncle gave me this job washing cars at his gas station. He said, as long as you don't get your hands in the till or wait on the customers, you can wash cars. So, which means stay in the back and stay away from people. I felt like, what's the Hunchback of Notre Dame? You know, I was kind of back there. I mean, and it's middle of winter. It's freezing cold. I don't spend my money on rubber boots and, you know, warm clothes. It's all on cigarettes and stuff like that. And I'm back there freezing to death. They opened a liquor store right across the street from the gas station where I was working while I'm back there. And I'm back there washing cars, just staring over at the liquor store. I mean, it was like torture. It was just torture. I couldn't imagine. And I just want to drink every day. I'm just completely crazy as a loon. I'm coming up on a year sober doing this. And I hate Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I just hate it. I hate everybody in it. I hate it. I hate everything. But by this time, one of the guys in AA has given me a job. I got a little place to stay at the farm. He gave me a job at this farm. Him and his wife were in AA. I'd ride to town with one of them one night to go to a meeting and the other one the next night to go to a meeting. I got a little place to stay out there. There was this abandoned trailer house that was on the farm that I shared with the possum for the first couple of years I was sober. I worked doing the kind of work I enjoyed doing. I'd made friends with the other guys that worked there at the farm. There were people all around me in Alcoholics Anonymous that loved me and cared for me. My mother was letting me come over on my day off and eat lunch at the house. And I'm coming up on a year, and I hate you guys. And I, and I, this is as close to a spiritual awakening as I know of. You know, I thought, what's wrong with you? You know, things are well. I quit hating you. I did what it says in our what we read tonight and how it works. It says we give ourselves to this simple program, and I gave myself to this simple program, and I did everything you asked me to do. Not always willingly, sometimes kicking and screaming, sometimes, but I did it. Nevertheless, I did it. I made those amends. I did that inventory. I went out and made those amends. Those are not fun. It's not fun. I don't ever want to be new again. You know, I've made lots of amends sober, don't get me wrong, but I don't ever want to go back and make the kind of ones I had to make when I got here. You know, just like anybody else that works this program, applies himself, works hard, does good, things got better. I mean, rapidly, really. I mean, when you start out so low, it's almost like you're shot out of a cannon. I mean, it's never always straight up, though, you know. And I did almost every mistake you can make in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've made it. I mean, I've just done it. The only thing I've really ever done right is I have not taken a drink, and I've kept coming back. I've never had a time where I've decided I'm not going to AA anymore. I know this is where I belong. These are my people. You are my people. I know that I belong here, and I've got to stay here by the grace of God. Don't get me wrong. And that took 7 or 8 years for me to get over. You know, 5, 6, 7 years into this deal, I'm sponsoring people and talking and going to conferences and doing everything, and I'm wanting to commit suicide. I mean, I just can't hardly stand myself. It's just crazy. The craziness would come back. Just waves, it seemed like. The depression or self-pity or just insanity, whatever it was, it would just overwhelm me. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought I'd come up with something that Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't solve. You know, I'm sitting at 7 years, and I look a lot better. I've got a haircut and a shave. I've got a job. I've got, you know, a place to stay. I've got all this stuff. But I'm not any better. You know what I mean? And I go to my sponsors thinking I'm going to stump the chump. You know, I got a problem that he can't solve. And he takes me back to the steps. And we start looking at that, you know, coming to believe. You know, have you came to believe in anything? I mean, and I couldn't say that I did. And I started doing a research. I started looking into it. I mean, I wanted to do anything but do business with God, if you want to know the truth. The God as I understood him, I was completely afraid of. And I just didn't want to do business with him. And at 7 or 8 years sober, I had to come to terms that either I got to go back out drinking again, or I'm going to do business with God as I understand him. And I did. And it's made a huge impact on my life. I mean, I researched a lot of stuff. If I'd had $1,500, I might have been a Maharishi yogi by now. But their deal really sounded better than Christianity, if you want to know the truth. But I didn't have $1,500, so they wouldn't let me get my magic word or whatever it was that was going to make me better. So I wound up being a Christian, and I'm telling you, it's changed everything. Having a relationship with God has changed everything. I don't think you have to wait 7 or 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to do that, okay? But if it happens that way, it happens that way. My wife and I got married, and you know, immediately, like 9 months and 15 minutes later, we have this little boy that looks just exactly like me. It's incredible. He's 17 years old now. We've been married 19 years this fall. She's a member of Al-Anon, going to celebrate 20 years in Al-Anon this fall. And honestly, we've got three kids. I've started groups. I've left them. You know, I got married and divorced before my wife and I got married. I mean, I've been fired from jobs. I've been hired to jobs. Everything that happens in life has happened. People have died. People have moved on. People disappoint you. Life happens, you know. But staying in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, being involved in this deal, I've always had a safe haven. I've always had a place to go. I've always had friends. Some of the two of the most important things that have happened to me is one, sponsorship. I mean, I cannot be without a sponsor. I just don't think I'm healthy without a sponsor. I've got to have a sponsor that's out in front of me, that's as active as I am or more, and as willing to serve, that's helping others. And the other thing is friends. I'm going to tell you, I have leaned as heavy on my friends in the last 2 or 3 years as ever in Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that us drunks don't have many long-term friends, if you think about it. We tend to cut ties and move on a lot of times in our life. And to have people around me that have known me for, you know, going on 30 years now, 20, 27 years now, to have people still in my life that have known me for that long to talk to relate to identify with is powerful. It's absolutely powerful. The other thing is the fact that when I was brand new, they said, you got to help others. They didn't wait for me to get through the steps. They didn't wait for any of that. They took me on 12-step calls with them. One time I remember telling them, I don't know what to say. They said, well, you don't have to say anything. We're going to use you as the bad example. So, and I just went with them, you know. I just went with them. Anybody that came in our group, we live in a little town, it's a little rural town, you know. Anybody that came in our group that was under 30 years old, they'd say, Steve, this is Joe. Joe, this is Steve. Steve's going to be your sponsor. I think, oh, my God, you know. And I know now that anybody that had a half a chance of sobering up, they would keep for themselves. They would only give me the ones that were going to die anyway, so I wouldn't really hurt them. But I learned how to get out of myself, how to help others right off the bat. There is no substitute for it. There's a lot of areas of service that we can participate and be involved in in Alcoholics Anonymous, but there is no substitute for helping others. We cannot remember where we came from. We do not have that ability. But for the grace of God, by staying involved, by sticking our hand out, by answering the phone, by spending time with new people, we don't ever have to repeat it again. Thank you for having me.